This is Once for All, where Jude 3 says, I found it necessary to write appealing to you to contend for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. Listen in as the faith held by believers of all times is now delivered to you.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Once for All. Happy Friday. And today's the day we keep our finger on the pulse of what's going on around the world, taking a look at some of the news headlines and analyzing them both from a political perspective as Christians are citizens in this world, and also from a Christian worldview perspective as Christians are in the world but not of the world. Always helping me with this on Fridays is Jeff Smith. Jeff, always great to have you on Fridays.
Yeah, it's great to be here this morning.
If anyone wants to join in the conversation today, you can do so by giving us a toll-free phone call, 1-844-51-FAITH. That phone number works no matter where you're listening. We are coming to you live this Friday morning, June the 30th. Again, the toll-free number, 1-844-51-FAITH. You can also send me an email, which I will read live on the air. Delivered once for all at gmail.com. Delivered once for all at gmail.com. Well, one of the things that happens every summer, Jeff, is that the Supreme Court goes on, they end their session in the month of July. And so every year around June, we get a bunch of Supreme Court decisions thrown at us. And this June has been no exception. A lot of Supreme Court decisions have been released. We're going to be stepping through a few of them, and then we'll be looking at an article from NPR. The first one of note that we've talked about before here on this show is Trinity Lutheran Church versus the state of Missouri. What happened was a Lutheran church has a playground, and they applied for this grant reimbursement program, and what it was is for the playground of that preschool, and they used recycled tires. They mulch up the tires, put it down on the playground, so if the kiddos fall down, they don't get hurt as badly. And the state of Missouri had a program that if you're a preschool, you can apply for this grant, and you can get some of your money reimbursed. Well, Trinity Lutheran Church, having a preschool, applied for that very grant, and they were denied. They ranked high in the application process, but were denied. They said that a state can't give funds to a church, and that was why it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decision favored in on the side of Trinity Lutheran Church 5-2, I believe. 7-2. Sorry, that doesn't add up. 7-2 in favor of Trinity Lutheran Church. So, Jeff, I have a few thoughts on this, but I want to get your perspective before we go there.
Well, I guess the first thing to look at is exactly what you just said there. The 7-2 decision is pretty decisive, because that includes a couple of the more liberal members of the court siding, you know, with the majority in this one. And I, you know, it's one of those things. I think both sides are trying to do the right thing in this, and trying to live by the letter of their law. So I'm not sure it was a, you know, Missouri trying to be discriminatory as much as maybe that they were trying to make sure they were within the law. I think that you know, maybe more reasonable people involved may have avoided this from going to the Supreme Court at all. But it does kind of open up the door for more, you know, more things that have been considered, you know, an unholy partnership between the church and the state, that, you know, maybe can be reexamined now.
Yeah. It seems like, that the First Amendment of the Constitution has been, pertaining to religion, has been, I don't know, misunderstood, or at least re-understood in recent years. Because if we remember what the Constitution actually says, you know, we always talk about the separation of church and state, which is not actually in the Constitution. I think that was an interpretation from Jefferson.
Yeah, it actually came from a letter written by Jefferson. But it was not even part of the deliberation in writing of the Constitution. It was a letter that was written after the Constitution had been ratified. So it really had nothing to do with what was in the Constitution.
So what the Constitution actually says is that Congress shall make no law establishing religion preventing the free exercise thereof. Now we can just kind of step back and ask the question, if the state gives money to a preschool that is at a church to reimburse them for tires, are we establishing a religion? And I think this person just saying, well, no, of course not establishing a religion. I would expect that if there's a Jewish synagogue that has a preschool, I would expect the state of Missouri to treat them fairly as well. So it seems like, and I think this is to, you know, we have those, what's that group called? The Freedom From Religion Foundation. We have them to thank for this misunderstanding of the Constitution, to think that the state has to have nothing to do with religion. I mean, once religion or a church comes up, we have to be, you know, hands off. Sorry, the state can't have anything to do with this. That's not what the Constitution says at all. We can't establish a religion. And not only that, it says Congress shall make no law establishing religion. So if a Department of Education or whatever department of the state of Missouri was giving these grants, that's not Congress, by the way. You know, there's no law establishing religion, and there's no coercion for someone who doesn't participate in religion. And that's what the framers of the Constitution want to get away from. But we think that any tax dollar money that goes towards anything religious is an establishment of religion, and that's just not the case.
No, and then, you know, that takes us back to some of the things about, you know, courthouses having the Ten Commandments on the wall and how many places where they've had to remove that. And, you know, and that probably gets to the, you know, to the point of the matter where it's, you know, more possibly, you know, something to be concerned with. Whether the Ten Commandments should be on the wall of a Supreme Court building in a certain state or any court building, but even in that case, I don't see that as an establishment of a religion. In fact, a lot of our laws, the morality laws that we have, whether you want to agree that they're based in the Bible, they're congruent with the Bible. They're, you know, so it doesn't seem that ridiculous. It's like I told someone that I was in an argument with, you know, over a religious thing one time, and I said, well, you know, can't you at least get some of the good things from the Bible without, if you want to dismiss the supernatural portion of the Bible, the fact that, you know, Jesus rose from the dead and all of that, and that he is God. And if you just remove that part, there's a lot of good things can be learned from the Bible, just like any other good piece of literature. And, you know, he rejected it, you know, out of hand, that I don't need a religion to tell me my morality and that thing. And it's like, well, I don't need it to tell me that either. A lot of these things we just kind of know inherently. But that doesn't mean we can't use the example of the Bible to remind us of what, you know, what the laws are there for, what morality is. I mean, without some sort of set of moral guidelines, we're not a civil society anymore, and the Constitution kind of becomes moot at that point. So
the Ten Commandments in courtroom discussion has always been an interesting one. For me, I really don't see a problem with it. I don't think that it breaks any kind of laws or anything like that. But I also never sought to be a hill to die on, you know. But I think where we have churches who are being denied equal access to public funds, when the only thing that disqualifies them is that they are a religious organization, where they could be a preschool that's nonprofit, non-religious, and then would get the funds, then obviously the only thing that is preventing them from getting the public funds is the fact that they're a church. And not only can you not establish a religion, you also can't discriminate on the basis of religion. At least that's the way that the laws have come to us to this point. So it is interesting, and I think I agree with you that the newsworthy headline here isn't just that religious freedom won in this case, but that it was a 7-2 decision, as you mentioned. I mean, that I certainly wasn't expecting that.
Well, and you're probably never going to see a 7-2 decision if this was a case of, you know, taking down the Ten Commandments in a courthouse. You would probably see a 5-4 decision, and not necessarily a 5-4 decision in favor of allowing that. So, yeah, there's a big difference. But and I agree with you that, you know, the whole thing about Ten Commandments in the public square or in the courthouse or whatever is not really a hill to die on. I definitely agree with that. However, in this case, it definitely is, because it's before this decision, they were discriminating against kids based on their religion. That's mm-hmm. really what was happening here. All the school children should be equal. Regardless of whether they go to a public school or a private school, they should all get equal treatment from the state. And this was clearly discriminating right. against a group, you know, a certain group of children. And again, I don't think that was the intent of mm-hmm. Missouri to, you know, to exclude them from this. I mean, they did it on religious grounds, but I don't think they thought of it as we're discriminating against right. these kids. But ultimately, that's what they were doing,
right.
and that's what the court has pointed out here in their decision.
Yeah, and I think we brought this up when we were talking about it last time. One of the arguments that was made on behalf of the church, I think they were defended by Alliance Defending Freedom, I believe. They're the group of lawyers that's been standing up for churches and things like religious liberty issues. And one of the arguments that was made by them during the argumentation was, look, if we're going to say that that they can't receive a public fund grant because they're a church, are we going to say that the fire department can't come and put a church out when it's on fire because, well, that would be applying public funds to a church? I mean, obviously, we need to be treating churches as equal organizations and not be discriminating upon, you know, what this organization does. When tax dollars go to a fire department, their job is to protect the property of the citizens in that jurisdiction. And so they're not going to discriminate on, you know, their favorite houses or their favorite businesses or anything else. I think that was a good argument. Apply that logic then to things like, you know, grants for whatever. We're not going to discriminate upon what the organization does.
Yeah, and I don't know that it would ever, you know, go any farther, but that would kind of take you to the point where you could say, well, there's Christians in this public school, so we can't give funding to them, because it sounds ridiculous. But, you know, every time we mention these slippery slope arguments, over time we're proved right. And so we have to be careful with this. So I think this at least gives us a reset and mm-hmm. allows us to kind of find our way from there. Excuse me. But on a side note, I'd been doing a little reading on this case, and apparently we have the Catholics to thank for this
yeah.
because Missouri originally put their law in to not allow funding for religious organizations because of some hostility toward the Catholic Church. So,
well, was that the Blaine Amendment? Is that what it's called?
You know, I think several states have laws yeah. that are based on the Blaine Amendment. Yes.
Okay.
And I think that's the one.
It was an awkward.
One of you can call in and correct us if we're getting that
yeah.
not quite right. But yeah, several of the states have these amendments that are now in, you know, they're sort of been reset here. They're kind of in
right.
flux because I think they were covering way more than they were intended to.
But it was an awkward thing to cite for a reason to not do this. It was, I mean, it seemed to me like they were grasping at straws. Like, all right, I mean, it's not like, okay, we have to apply this. We've been doing it for 100 years. It's like, oh, we're being discriminatory. Someone find something that we can cite to give us a reason that we can't do this, and this is what they came up with. So, yeah, you're right. I think it's good to see that this decision came down from the Supreme Court. Let's take a break right now. When we get back, we'll be talking about another Supreme Court decision that the travel ban for President Trump that he has proposed was, at least for the most part, okayed by the Supreme Court. We'll be right back.
The phone lines are now open. Call toll-free 1-844-51-FAITH. That's 1-844-51-FAITH. This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
We all have busy weeks, but few have as many life-altering events in 7 days' time as this young mother of four. She was despairing and hopeless as she approached the abortion mill. She and her boyfriend were facing truly difficult circumstances and expecting their fifth child. The pro-life sidewalk counselor offered them assistance to overcome these challenges. Not only did she choose life for her baby, she welcomed Jesus into her heart. After telling her boyfriend they were not aborting their baby, he responded, "Then let's get married now." The sidewalk counselor provided a ring that fit perfectly. The pro-life group funded a thrift store dress and shoes, a garden wedding, and a honeymoon night in a fancy downtown hotel, plus continued help. God is good.
Follow us on Twitter at Life Issues USA and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
In today's Takedown Minute, David Scare highlights the value of using a consistent liturgy, even to the point where you might feel like you're in a liturgical rut. That's not all bad, he says. Liturgical ruts have advantages in letting parishioners know where they are going because they know where they have been. The perfect church service would be one we were almost unaware of and with the least surprises. Not long ago, our denomination had only one order of service for 6,000 congregations. People moving from one place to another knew what to expect. They never really left home. Hymns and music might change, but the menu remained the same. That was David Scare for today's Takedown Minute.
With the SRN News Business Brief, I'm Dennis Crowley. A report from the government says Congress must increase the government's borrowing limit by early to mid-October or face a first-ever default on U.S. obligations. The Congressional Budget Office also predicts the federal budget deficit will spike to $693 billion this year. This is $134 billion more than it predicted in January, mostly because of slipping tax revenue projections. Walgreens has ended its takeover pursuit of rival Rite Aid following resistance from U.S. regulators. Instead, Walgreens will buy nearly 2,200 stores from Rite Aid, along with three distribution centers and related inventory for more than $5 billion in cash. And on Wall Street, the Dow dipped almost 166 points. With business, I'm Dennis Crowley.
Welcome back to Once for All, talking about some of the Supreme Court decisions of the United States. And among them, Jeff, I might let you talk about this one as an introduction, that the Supreme Court was asked to weigh in on the so-called travel ban for President Trump. And what was the result?
Well, they reinstated the travel ban, sort of. This was an odd decision because they really didn't. They put this off until I think they said October that they'll revisit this, but they did reinstate the travel ban, but they're still going to look at it. So basically what they said was, you know, the lower courts were wrong on this, or at least we feel like that they're going to be wrong on this. The president has the power to do these things, and we're going to reinstate it. Although they did give some caveats, which is, you know, this whole thing is kind of a mess. Now, I will say that the travel ban went into effect, and we didn't see, you know, a lot of the chaos that ensued with the first travel ban, partially because I think the Trump administration kind of learned their lessons from the first time around. They really implemented something that they weren't prepared for. They really hadn't thought it through. I'm not even a fan of this travel ban to begin with, but I recognize that the president has this within his powers. It's been, you know, shown in the law that he can do this. But then the court did what the court likes to do in the last half century, and they like to, you know, add or subtract things to, you know, to make it work for them. You know, they gave some caveats of people that can establish a true connection, whether it be family members or whatever other stipulations they gave. And that's just not the court's place. Your job is to say this is either constitutional or it's not. You can give suggestions. You can say this is why it's not constitutional. So, for instance, if they throw a law out because it's not constitutional, they can say why they did that so that the Congress can go back and adjust the law to meet the constitutional standard. That's the way it's supposed to work. Unfortunately, over the last, you know, half century or more, the courts decided that they want to make law. They want to be part of it. It was no more evident than with the Obamacare decision where the Supreme Court basically changed the wording of the law to make it fit constitutional muster, and that's not their job. That's not what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what they did here, except that they ruled, but they didn't rule. So they're going to be reevaluating this down the road. So the way the decision came out was kind of messy and kind of unfortunate, but all in all, the rule of law was upheld here. The president has the power to do this, whether we agree with him or not. And I'm not against some sort of restriction. I just don't know, you know, that the way he's done this is right. Although I also don't agree with the media, the way they've characterized this as a Muslim ban.
Well, I was going to throw that at you and get your response. I'm interested to see what you say about it. I mean, again, we're asking the question of what of the Constitution makes this unconstitutional. I mean, we have to have something to lean on. And the only thing they've come up with is this, the ban is targeting one's religion, which is ironic given what we just discussed in the last segment. And they say, well, look, he's trying to fight against, you know, Muslim terrorism. And so to ban people just because they're Muslim, then therefore that's unconstitutional. What do you say?
Well, there's a couple things going on there. First of all, in the lower court decisions, they were looking at what he had said on the campaign trail and not what was in the actual ban. Well, that, as much as it's...
That's classy.
Well, you know, as unfortunate as it might be that his words were inflammatory, you know, on the campaign trail, he wasn't the president, and that has nothing to do with the ban. The ban is... It's just like any other contract. It has words that have meanings, and there's nothing in the ban that mentions Muslims. The countries that he chose happen to be primarily Muslim, but he didn't choose them because of their religious lean. He chose them because of their inability to control the terrorism that's
right.
coming out of those countries. So, and he has, you know, the president has that, you know, that right, that leeway to do that. But on the other hand, one of the stations where I get listen to some of my talk radio when I'm not listening to our local station, 94.3 The Bridge.
Which is hardly ever, I'm sure.
It's only a couple hours a day. But they happen to carry Fox News for their top of the hour news. And even Fox News was characterizing this as a Muslim ban. And it's like, you may think that that's the intent, and you have every right to have that opinion, but that's just factually incorrect.
Right.
This is not a Muslim ban. It's banning, again, people from countries where they're not showing the ability to keep terrorists from coming into other countries, including our own.
So if I'm a citizen of Syria and I'm a Christian, I also cannot travel to the United States.
Yeah, well, that's my understanding.
Right.
I
did understand there were some exceptions, but there wasn't a religious test.
Right.
It was, you know, what country are you coming from?
Well, and I think in the first ban that got thrown out and he changed it, I don't know that it was in the ban, but in the enforcement of it, there seemed to be some people that were treating it as a religious test. Mm-hmm. So it's good that they fixed that, because that it shouldn't, you know, it should apply the same to whether they're Christians, right, or Jewish, or, you know, whatever. But it also gets back to the problem of, and we've talked about this with the gender issue, we have to quit ignoring things that we know to be true. We know where these terrorists are coming from. We know what their intentions are. And I would go back to the fact that it doesn't matter that if most Muslims say this is not our form of Islam, the people that are carrying out these terrorist acts, they think they're acting in the name of their God. It doesn't matter what we think. It doesn't matter what other Muslims think. They think this is how they carry out their religion. And we have to be aware of that. You know,
sure,
you can call it profiling, but profiling to me in a lot of cases is just good police work.
Right.
And again, we've talked about it on the show, you know, previously. I've given the example of, you know, if I thump a guy over a head with a baseball bat, the first thing they're going to tell the cop was he was a short white guy. He's not profiling me. That's just good police work.
That's prejudice against short whites. Yeah, I remember a while ago hearing a interview with an expert from Islam, and the host asked the guest, you know, what's the one thing that at the time of I heard the interview, it was during the Obama administration, what's the one thing that the Obama administration doesn't understand about Islam? And the answer that the expert provided was that the Obama administration assumes that Islam also has this separation between church and state in their theology. So here we are as Americans, we talk about the separation of church and state, you know, we try to keep these two things distinct, but in the mind of a Muslim, you know, the Muslim who reads the Quran and believes what the Quran says, there is no such separation. So that everything that you do in a religious way, you also do in a way to try and promote the state of Islam. So you can't make the distinction between the two. Well, that actually might segue into the final Supreme Court decision that we wanted to talk about today. And this is an interesting one. It reversed a Arkansas Supreme Court decision. And what happened in Arkansas was that, so yeah, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States established that same-sex marriage is legal in the nation. And so a same-sex married couple in Arkansas applied for a birth certificate, and they wanted both of these men to be listed as parents on the birth certificate. And the state of Arkansas would not allow that, because anyone who's been to a biology class knows that it was not two men who brought about a child. It had to be a man and a woman. And so,
well, and I'll correct you on this
please.
One. It was actually a lesbian couple,
oh, okay.
but it would apply the same,
right,
obviously.
Right. Thank you. And so the state of Arkansas said, okay, we're going to say that can't be put down. Now, as this went through the Supreme Court of Arkansas, they said, they upheld that opinion of the state. And then at the Supreme Court level of the United States, it was actually reversed. Now, what I find interesting is actually the dissenting opinion of Neil Gorsuch, the newest member of the Supreme Court. And, you know, the courts have this, and I forget the legal Latin phrase that it is, but the court has wants to respect the precedent of its previous decisions. So if a court has ruled one way, it tries to keep that decision in mind as it moves forward. In other words, you don't want the Supreme Court flip-flopping. You know, you respect the decision of the previous court. So in that regard, the Supreme Court, in a way, did that in regards to same-sex marriage. But what was fascinating was the dissenting opinion from Neil Gorsuch, who said that the state has the right to understand biology in terms of parenthood. In other words, when the Supreme Court makes a decision like what is marriage, that might set the laws of the land, so to speak, but that can't change the laws of the universe of what makes a child. So go ahead on your thoughts on this.
Yeah, and that's what I find a little troubling with this is this decision is a birth certificate. This is not about discriminating in any way against anybody, any type of, whether it be, LGBT or, race or whatever. This is not, this is what you're saying, and this is intended to show where the child came from, who the birth parents of the child are. A lesbian couple did not give birth to that child. One of those women may have given birth to it, but in a lot of cases, neither one of them are the birth mother. So, and maybe it shows that we need a more expansive system for this where you would show, who the parents are going to be following the birth of this child. But I still think we need to be keeping track of who the biological parents are, just as with gender. We need to keep track of the biological gender when it comes to government documents. That doesn't mean, again, we can't set up other ways of recognizing, again, we've talked about it. If we want to have this social construct of 60 plus genders, I suppose the government could have a way to recognize that, but we shouldn't throw out the scientific biological identifiers of who the parents are, what the gender is. They're not mutually exclusive. We can have both, but we have to have the one that's based in facts and in science. And in the only way we would have to really identify, genetic things. And I mean, if you list two lesbian parents as the parents on a birth certificate, and then you go back looking for genetic markers, well, you're not going to find genetic markers for that child from at least one of those parents, and potentially both of them,
right,
if the child was carried by a surrogate. So
it does the child a disservice just because we're trying to force.
Yeah, so I don't think it's one or the other.
Right.
We need to maybe expand the system to encompass more, more facts or more information. But we can't just throw out the fact that biology exists and that each child has a biological mother and a biological father.
Mm-hmm.
So I would agree with Justice Gorsuch on this, is that, this is not, I don't know. And you mentioned the precedents, that they always try and look at precedents. I that's been one of my complaints with the courts in general, for all the years that I've paid attention to this, is they give a little too much credence to precedents. And the perfect example would be the Korematsu decision.
Mm-hmm.
Korematsu was a horrible decision by the court. There should never be another court ruling that gives any look at precedents to the Korematsu decision.
Right.
So I think at times they lean a little too much on previous actions, and they need to dig into to what the law actually is. Precedents to me is almost really, doesn't matter unless that precedent also supports the law that you're trying to interpret.
In our balance of powers in our nation, if any branch is a little heavy, it's the judicial branch, in the way that it's been executed. And for the reason that we're talking about, so the Congress is making laws, they're doing their thing, the executive branch is doing their thing or his thing, but when the court makes a ruling on a law, then that sort of concretes for the future. And so in a way, you might think even what carries more power than even the president is that Supreme Court of the United States. At least that's the way that de facto, and I'm not saying it's written that way, but that's de facto what's been going on. But so that, again, to reiterate, what's so fascinating about this case is you might step back and go, well, what's more powerful than the United States Supreme Court? And Neil Gorsuch says, nature is. you can't rewrite the laws of nature, even with a Supreme Court decision. And I'm going to go to a biblical source on that, too. This is Romans chapter 1, where it deals with the topic of homosexuality. And, you know, those who say that homosexuality isn't really addressed in the Bible don't know what they're talking about. So in Romans chapter 1, Paul's talking about how because they have suppressed the truth of God, that they just chase after the passions in their flesh. And then he picks up in 1:24, therefore God gave them over in the, verse 26, for this reason of following after the lust of their heart, God gave them over to the degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way, also the men abandoned the natural function of the women and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. So when the Romans 1 talks about homosexuality, it cites this matter of something being natural or unnatural. Now, I remember 3 or 4 years ago or something, one of the, and I don't know a lot about the show, but one of the gentlemen on Duck Dynasty said homosexuality was unnatural. That's all he said. It's unnatural. And that's, you know, when the wheels fell off the wagon and he was, you know, was ridiculed, advertisers were targeted by the left because how dare this person say homosexuality is unnatural? Well, guess what? You can't change the laws of the universe. I'm sorry.
Well, it forces you into this position where, you know, we had talked about one of the president's nominees and Bernie Sanders losing his mind over his statement of his religious beliefs. Now, granted, he was conflating, you know, eternal damnation with some sort of earthly damnation. And so that was part of the problem there. But, you know, the Duck Dynasty thing you mentioned, that's his religious belief because that's what Christianity teaches. It gets taken to the point where, in a lot of cases, laws have discriminated against, you know, we've had different sexual laws that may have been discriminatory toward homosexuals, and some people might be okay with those laws, but in general, the way our country was founded and the way our Constitution is, they're probably not good laws because they are discriminatory. No matter how much a Christian may think those things are terrible, we can't necessarily discriminate against them. And it's hard to know where the line gets drawn with that. But coming back to what you said, the natural thing, I'm not even sure that he was espousing his religion there, although in his case, I think he was. But he could easily just be espousing the biology of things that, you know, the sex creates life. That's what it's intended for, regardless of the other, you know, circumstances that go into that. That's the main purpose of sexual intercourse, is to produce a new life. Mm-hmm. And gay sex can't do that. I mean, right. That's, you know, and right. I'm not trying to be too graphic,
no,
but that's,
you're right.
That's the fact of the matter.
And this is the thing, because of this, what, political correctness and really the punishment that those have seen in practicing their businesses in a particular way. We've talked a lot about that already. We're developing kind of a emperor with no clothes kind of a thing, so that no one wants to say anything until someone comes along and says, points out the obvious. So we're tiptoeing around the issue. We're creating laws and that would teach us. And now we're, you know, telling our children, you know, don't say anything. But if someone just came from another planet and looked around and watched, you know, men marrying men and women wearing women, they'd say, boy, that's not natural. And everybody would gasp, but how dare you say that? Well, just a reasonable observer can tell that it's not natural, but we've been conditioned to not say anything because of the laws around us.
Yeah, and the example I would give, and I don't want to give, you know, too deep a look into my heart, but I would say, yeah, well, nobody wants to go there. That's a dark place. No, but seriously, the example I would give is as a younger person, as a school age person, when I first became aware of what homosexuality was, seeing two men kissing made me very, very physically uncomfortable. It wasn't, it didn't come from a place of bias. I hadn't,
right.
I knew nothing of one way or the other. It gave me a physical reaction that made me very uncomfortable. I couldn't control that, but I also didn't understand it. And as we've, you know, society has progressed, I would say with air quotes to a certain extent, to where we have accepted that sort of thing as more, you know, normal. And again, I would throw the air quotes on there because I don't think it's normal. However, we've accepted that people can do what they want to do. That feeling hasn't changed. I have no I don't want to discriminate against anybody for any reason, including homosexuals. It's none of my business. I have my own sin to worry about. Mm-hmm. I don't need to worry about the sin of others. However, I still get that same physical feeling seeing two men kissing. And to me, that's because it's not natural.
Right.
It's not biologically, it's not natural. There's no other explanation for why it makes me feel that way. And again, I have no hatred toward those people. I don't really care. They can do what they want as long as it doesn't affect me. And that two men kissing doesn't affect me in any way, except that physically it does. And I didn't really realize this until my son asked me about it one time. He had made a comment about, you know, showing, you know, like, I don't know if it was a TV show or what the situation was, but he was having that exact same feeling that I had had as a child. And I tried to explain to him that, you know, you can understand that that's not a natural thing, but not carry that into being discriminatory towards anyone. Mm-hmm. And it's a struggle. I can understand how people have gotten to the point where they want to discriminate against things that are unnatural because of the feeling that it gives them. And I didn't know, like I said, when I first realized this in my own life, I didn't even know what homosexuality was at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. I mean, maybe I was sheltered, but you know, it was the 80s. It mm-hmm. was still somewhat taboo. In fact, when the AIDS epidemic hit, it almost was used as a proof that it's taboo. You're being punished from God. Now, that's a ridiculous statement, but those things were being said.
Mm-hmm.
And even some in the gay community were like, why is this happening to us? Why is it now? There's scientific reasons for why it spread so quickly in the gay community, mainly due to what their lifestyle at that point was, and how it's transmitted. So you put the two together and that becomes a real problem. But again, I until that point, I really didn't even know what homosexuality was. It may have been discussed in church at some point, but if it was, I didn't recall it. So again, we get to this point where we're supposed to just separate ourselves from things that we know, you know, conclusively know are true, whether it be, you know, a child has a mother and a father biologically and has a biological gender. We can have those things and still recognize people's rights. And I think that's where it gets conflated, where we're supposed to not only recognize people's rights, but we're supposed to reject science.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I kind of lean toward the natural part of this, is that, you know, to me, that was a physical reaction for me. So
sure. And
I can't explain it except to say that, you know, I knew inherently that that's not natural.
Right.
And again, I'm not trying to be discriminatory. That's just how I felt.
We bottom line, and this I think is what we're talking about, the main kind of parting shot on this, the story, is that you can't change the laws of nature. The laws of nature are the laws of nature. Now, from a pastoral perspective, I would say that God had fixed the laws of nature in this world to be consistent with his moral law. But it doesn't matter, even if someone isn't a Christian, doesn't even believe in God, the atheist has to live within those laws of nature too. And just denying that the laws of nature are there doesn't actually change anything. We're so narcissistic to think that if the Supreme Court says that this marriage is legitimate, then it somehow is going to produce children. It just isn't. That's not how science works. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we have one more story for you after this break, a story from NPR about the importance of fatherhood. We'll be right back.
The phone lines are now open. Call toll-free 1-844-51-FAITH. That's 1-844-51-FAITH.
Now it's time for Table Talk Extras with Pastor Brian Wolf-Mueller.
Imagine a ravenous wolf. I mean, ravenous means hungry, starving, skinny because it hasn't eaten in so long. And so with its lips licking its chops and the gleam in its eye, it's coming after you to devour you, and nothing is going to get in its way. That's the terrible kind of imagery that Jesus gives when he talks about false prophets. Ravenous wolves who seek to devour you. But there's something else that Jesus says. They come to you, not as outwardly dressed ravenous wolves, but dressed in sheep's clothing. Now this is the problem. If we see a ravenous wolf, if we see a starving bear, if we see a mangy, hungry lion charging for us to devour us, we know just what to do. You don't even have to think about it. You run. But if we see a little lamb, a little sheep, just looking cuddly and cute and looking at us with big, round, wet eyes, we say, oh, what a beautiful little thing. And we go up to it and we pet it and we cuddle it and we invite it home and we feed it with the cats, this sort of thing. So it is that false teachers find their way into the church because they do not look outwardly like what they are inwardly. They are ravenous wolves who will stop at nothing to destroy us. But they look like peaceful little sheep. So Jesus says you will know them by their fruits, by their words, by their teaching. Do they bring me Christ crucified for the forgiveness of my sins? Do they preach the law in its harshness and the gospel in its sweetness? Or do they bring me some sort of mixture of law and gospel, of forgiveness and works? If this ravenous wolf has found its way into your house, throw it out. For you know just what it is.
This has been a production of Table Talk Radio. For more information, visit tabletalkradio.org.
This is Sacred Meditations. Almighty God, you have built your church upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. Grant us so to be joined together in unity of spirit by their teaching, that we may be made a holy temple acceptable to you, through Jesus Christ our Lord, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever. Amen. Learning to pray by actually praying, this is sacredmeditations.org. Thank you for making Sacred Meditations part of your day.
All right, we're back here on Once for All, final segment of the program. I've got one more story to talk to you about. This is a story from NPR, very fascinating. The headline says, Poverty Dropouts, Pregnancy, Suicide, What the Numbers Say About Fatherless Kids. And the article proceeds to talk about the effects that fatherless homes, where you have children who are living in a home without their biological father, what effects that has on children. And get this number, Jeff, that 24.7 million kids in the U.S. live without a biological father. That's a staggering number. But as it goes on, it talks about, the effects that it has on children. We could read maybe a little bit here. Let's see. Fatherlessness is having a great impact on education. First of all, it's growing, and the correlations with any number of risk of issues are considerable. Children are four times more likely to be poor if the father's not around. And we know that poverty is heavily associated with academic success. Fatherless kids are also twice as likely to drop out. And then the question of this expert was, the fatherless affect boys and girls differently. It says, the research that I've seen is that girls are twice as likely to suffer from obesity without the father present, they're four times more likely to get pregnant as teenagers, and boys are more likely to act out, which is why we're more aware of how they're affected. But if a girl, a young girl, is imploding, we don't see it. So this article is not different than all the others that we've seen, that fathers play a huge role in the lives of children. Now, that is worthwhile talking about in of itself, but what I think is interesting is this coming from NPR, which is also an organization that promotes leftist agendas. And we might compare this story with the one we just got done talking about, that people are saying they have the right to be lesbians and have a child, when that is saying that a father is not necessary. So which is it? Is a father not necessary, or do fathers bring a important role to the upbringing of kids? We're short on time. We have about 3 minutes for you to respond, Jeff.
Well, the first thing I would note in this article, and it really points out what you're saying, that this came from NPR, and they're kind of contradicting the whole narrative they've been trying to create for the last, 20 plus years, is that they specifically said biological father. They didn't even say whether a two-parent household.
Right.
They specifically were talking about the biological father. And one of the most disturbing things that I saw in this, and I actually haven't gotten to dig into this as deep as I wanted to, was the issue of teen suicide. Mm-hmm. And that the numbers would suggest that growing up without a father makes a child twice as likely to commit suicide. That's staggering.
Right.
And we talk about, suicide a lot these days, and especially with the youth. And it also focuses on something we talk about a lot, but never seem to do anything about. And that would be in the inner city, where the fathers are not present in many, many cases. But instead of doing anything about it, we just keep watching the trend grow to the greater society.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, people are going to have to start taking marriage seriously.
Yeah.
It's become all too easy to just give up and toss a marriage to the side. And now we're seeing that the numbers show that has a really drastic negative effect on kids. And this article, definitely points that out.
Well, one thing that I found interesting about the article is the question, the expert that said, what about the so-called deadbeat dads who are bringing a negative impact on children? And it was said in the article that we need to bring some intervention to these dads, bring some correction to their behavior. But the idea of just getting those dads away from kids is not the best thing for the kids. We need to correct the dads and promote better behavior. I'll give you 30 seconds for a last word.
Yeah, that I would agree with that. I was really taken aback when I read that part of the article that they were not even suggesting that even in that case that they should be separated from the father. So it's an interesting study. It's an interesting article. It's surprising that it came from NPR, but it really doesn't matter where it came from. I would encourage everybody to go out and look this up. It's an NPR article, and it poverty, dropouts, pregnancy, and suicide, and there's more to the title, but I would search that. I would encourage everybody to take a look at that.
Yeah, very worthwhile your time. Well, that's going to be it for us today on Once for All. Thanks for tuning us in today, and we will join you again next week. Check out our website, onceforallradio.com.
This has been Once for All. You can contact the show by sending an email, deliveredonceforall@gmail.com. You can listen again to this show or any other episodes by visiting onceforallradio.com. Until next time, stand firm in the faith, once delivered to the saints.